Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
Hey EU Startups, if you're running a startup like me, you have more than enough on your plate. So when a prospect asks if your company is ISO 27001 or SOC 2 compliant, you're probably thinking, how the heck are we going to do this? We don't have the time, we don't have the manpower, and we definitely don't have the know-how. That's where Sitel comes in. With our automated platform and in-house expert to manage the entire process for you, you'll get compliant super fast. Compliance has never been easier.
So if you need help with compliance, visit sitale.ai/EU startups. That's sitale.ai/EU startups for $1,000 off your first framework. Hey everyone, this is Marcin Lewandowski and you're listening to the EU Startups Podcast. My next guest is Jaron Valler. Jaron is the founder and partner at Target Global. And he's responsible for Target's growth stage investment practice, where he led the investments in well-known companies, including WeFox, DogPlanner, Delivery Hero, Bird, and the list goes on. Jaron, it's such a pleasure to have you on the show. Everyone, give it up for Jaron. Welcome.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Hey, so let's cut straight to it. European countries are, you know, pouring billions into defense. Is this a golden opportunity for startups, or are we still miles behind?
So, you know, there's a McKinsey survey that says that Europe is 5 years behind the US. Mm-hmm. I think that's an understatement. I think that Europe is behind on two things. It's behind on building an effective defense force, and it's behind on developing a cadre of people that can give it a competitive advantage. Defense is one competitive advantage for the next generations. And I think that this problem is a lot more, you know, fundamental. Mm-hmm. We need to change something fundamental in the way Europeans see success and failure, see mm-hmm. their goals. There are several generations that have forgotten the sacrifice and the hard work that went into being able to have a lifestyle which is balancing work and other things. And we need to go a little bit back to basics. We need to look at it as a wake-up call and as a time of crisis that will create a much more fundamental shift in Europe. Defense startups, I don't think that the European defense in the next decade or the next two decades will come from new startups that are developed. Defense tech takes takes decades to develop and takes decades to deploy. And it's not a technology where you can make mistakes. I mean, you know, everyone's looking at Israel's Iron Dome. This was developed over the course of 15 years. If not longer. I'm sure they started developing it or started thinking about it decades ago. Yeah. So I highly doubt that that this is where the opportunity lies for startups. I think that again, we need to have a much more fundamental shift, and I'm happy mm-hmm. to talk about some of the elements that the shift like that would require.
Yeah, I mean, Jaron, you've seen firsthand how Israel has built a powerhouse of like kind of dual use technologies, right? So maybe let's talk about it a bit. What's the single biggest lesson Europe should take from Israel's playbook?
So first of all, look, I'm not a defense expert by any stretch of the imagination. You know, I'm ruminating about this as a business person. And as someone who cares deeply for Europe, you know, Europe has been my home for the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. It's a continent I care very deeply about. I did part of my education in Europe. I did my master's in France. So, you know, yeah. I really see myself as a European more than anything else mm-hmm. by now. And this is, again, something that I say with you know, first of all, a lot of care, because I don't want to be perceived as someone who teaches anyone a lesson. You know, it's not, mm-hmm. that's not the point. Europe is very different than Israel. Israel is a country of 10 million people. It's much easier to do things in a country of 10 million people than in the continent of 500 million. And then if we look at what Israel did correctly, was to build an educational and national service infrastructure that mm-hmm. was always that always fed into industry and fed from industry. So it was a full cycle. And it starts with how you educate kids. What is the goal that these kids have? You know, if you look at an Israeli mother or an Israeli father, their dream is that their son would be, or daughter would be, an engineer. Mm-hmm. Why an engineer? I mean, Germany has amazing engineers, right? Because engineers in Israel are taught also one more thing, to aspire to do big things, to try. And many times, if you look at engineers in developed countries, where there is a developed infrastructure and developed industry that people can go into, they're risk-averse people. They would prefer mm-hmm. to go and innovate in big companies. And that's eventually stifling the economy. Because without a massive, massive potential of becoming really wealthy from doing these things, people mm-hmm. don't initiate as much over time. So establishing that that type of startup ecosystem that Israel has, mm-hmm. to the extent that it is needed and desired by Europe, would require, one, changing the mindset of what is success. And success is not having 60 days of vacation a year, but rather success is being very successful in business or doing something great. Uh-huh. You know, you don't see a lot of great entrepreneurs that aspire to have 60 days of vacation or that aspire to talk about a 4-day work week. Mm-hmm. So this requires a fundamental change, and fundamental change usually comes through crisis. The second thing is to change or adapt the education system, and then potentially the national service system to support this. National service, and it doesn't necessarily have to be the army, but national service serves several very, very important goals in Israeli society, and they can serve the same goals in Europe. One, you are learning how to be a better citizen. You're learning that you're not only working for your benefit, but you are part of a society, and you cannot be an individualist in everything, but rather you have to sacrifice something for the greater good. And this is something very important that this teaches you. The second thing, and this is more fundamental to the questions that you are asking me, is the need to build a top grade and fairly cheap technological cadre that can provide Europe with a competitive advantage. One of the biggest successes of Israel is an army unit called 8200. 8200 mm-hmm. is the equivalent of the NSA. It's the single largest unit in the Israeli army. And what they do is they take kids out of school and train them how to be excellent in technology. They train them how to be hackers. They train them how to be programmers. They train them how to be best at cybersecurity. And this then later feeds into all of the economy. Mm-hmm. Now, this brings me to the question of dual use that you know is often discussed, and you mentioned just now as well. Yeah. The only way to attract that level of people is by offering them opportunities afterwards. For example, the opportunity to use what they learned in the army or what they learned in national service and do something civilian. You can look at, just thinking about a very old example, a company like Checkpoint that came out of a similar development of these people in the army. So the army didn't get a cent from what they did with this technology outside, and nor should it have. That was the package deal, right? You give me 4 or 5 years of your life, and then you have all these wonderful opportunities. And again, you know, these are very, very complex questions, but if we try to take some positive lessons from history, look at the Napoleonic reforms, which established, to a certain extent, established France as a nation. Mm-hmm. They focused on several things, two of which were having a single curriculum for everyone and having everyone in the army. Because you want to dictate how people develop. Again, it can become, you know, it's a double-edged sword, because it can become very dangerous if you do too much. But if you encourage it and you do it voluntarily, you know, at the end of the day, the people that go to the army in Israel, I mean, yes, everyone goes, but at the end of the day, what you do is voluntary. And how much effort you put into it is voluntary. And this is something that needs to be applied here as well. Otherwise, it becomes too restrictive, and you achieve exactly the opposite. So, sorry, long-winded answer, but it's not always easy to learn lessons from what happens in Israel. It's not always relevant to Europe. The lesson I would probably learn is mostly around education, building this. This cycle of dual use, and, you know, basically industry feeding the army and army feeding the industry.
Nice. So insightful, Yaron. Speaking about, you know, technology and this emphasize that you're saying is there to teach people the technology. So, you know, cybersecurity, AI, drones, what's the most exciting area right now that investors aren't paying enough attention to?
Look, so investors are paying attention to all of the things you said, but the harder things get, the harder it is for the private sector to contribute. Look at two very interesting European companies that both went bust recently, Lilium and Volocopter. These were companies that were largely funded, at least initially, by the private sector. And the private sector didn't have the means or the patience to develop them. They're not necessarily relevant to the question that you asked, because I'm not suggesting that these are the technologies that people should pay attention to. But just to make the answer a little bit more complex, it's not always that investors should pay attention. It's that, you know, a country should pay attention. I'll give you an example, something that Europe hadn't lost. Europe had a thriving semiconductor ecosystem in the 90s. And, you know, there were a lot of semiconductor fabrication plants in and around Europe. Then for two decades, everyone thought that this is a low-skill job and it can go to places where labor is not expensive. Yeah. And Europe lost all of that industry. And even the assumption that was behind losing this industry was incorrect. The assumption that this would be non-differentiated and this would be manufacturing proved to be completely false. And we see how that served countries like Taiwan. So when you're coming to look at the challenges for the 21st century, defense and otherwise, you need to think about the strategic strengths of Europe and not lose the ones that you have, like the leadership that you had in semiconductors. You know, if you think about the 80s, Philips and Siemens were very innovative when it came to semiconductors. Yeah. And a lot of the design work was being done in places like the UK or France. And then over two decades, Europe purposefully lost it and just completely gave up on this industry. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was on purpose or just because of lack of management, but throughout the continent, you see that mm-hmm. this industry has been lost. I mean, look, specifically now, I think that we need to pay attention to all the innovation that's going on in areas like quantum, which will disrupt communications and computing altogether. Of course, AI. AI is the great disruptor now. You know, And then of course innovate in robotics, which Europe has a tradition of being very strong at. And you know, we see a lot of innovation in robotics coming out of ETH in Zurich and other places, and also from the Gdynia region. So you know, there needs to be an emphasis on things that Europe is good at, and Europe has amazing manufacturing, amazing engineering. It has really a lot of talent, pockets of a lot of talent, but I think the main thing is that it needs to think how to build ecosystems around this talent, how to differentiate between pockets of excellence and pockets of people that have really good skills. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you need to keep developing the skills so these pockets of excellence expand. Another thing is that there is an over-tendency in Europe to focus on negative aspects of technology. Europeans mm-hmm. are very conscious when it comes to privacy, when it comes to civil rights. And these are things that are very important. You know, they're important to us because we learn from history. Because so many people were killed over the last, 2,000 years, really, in wars around Europe. So we've implemented the lesson, and we're very careful about these things. But when you let your ethics, to an extent, hamstring you, you know, delay you, and someone else will run faster, and beat you to the punch, it becomes very dangerous. You know, I'm going to repeat a sentence that I heard this week that I don't necessarily believe in, but is to an extent true. It's something that I don't remember who said about Ukraine. You can have justice or peace. You cannot have justice and peace. First of all, because justice is relative. So justice to one party is not necessarily justice to the other party. And the second reason is that sometimes justice and peace don't go hand in hand. You have to make sacrifices for peace. And the sacrifice is at the expense of justice sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Jarent, but because speaking actually of this military tech and the things you're talking about right now, some investors shy away from defense, right? How do you respond when founders or LPs ask, should VCs be funding military tech?
But again, so there are two questions here. One is the ethical question, and the other one is the practicality question. You need to ask mm-hmm. yourself why invest in startups in defense tech. There needs to be a really good reason. Mm-hmm. You remember that venture capital funds are raised for a cycle of 10 years, usually. Mm-hmm. So something fundamental in these funds, it might not be suitable for defense. So that's one thing. And let's stay away from this argument, because I think you're more asking about the moral argument. And the moral argument, again, I'm going back to what I just said. Sometimes you can have justice or peace, not both. At the end of the day, if you want to survive, and you know, far be it from me to give anyone lessons about surviving, but if you want to survive, you need to do certain things. You need to have an army. You need to be able to purchase stuff for that army. You need to work with your natural allies, and in a very, you know, we need to work mm-hmm. with our natural allies in a world that's changing around us. So, and we need to do it quickly. And that's the other thing. You know, if you have a public debate about everything, then you don't get shit done. And mm-hmm. and again, if you want to survive, sometimes you need to get shit done and not just talk about it.
100% agreed. Jarent, you also mentioned Germany how many great talented engineers they have. But also, you know, Germany just unlocked like 500 billion euros for defense. If you were starting a fund focused purely on military and dual use tech, what would your first investments be?
They probably wouldn't be at early stage startups, because that is not going to yield in time. Mm-hmm. Look, again, I don't know. I know that there are a lot of people in Europe talking about defense funds. I need to be convinced that there is enough merit for it. In two respects. One, that the startups are not going to burn massive amounts of cash and not produce any advantage, which is something that happens when governments throw a lot of money at the problem. And two, that that the things will be actionable within the time frame that we have. And again, I think that if I were a European decision maker today, I would focus on education. You can say that several more times. Then I would focus on partnerships between the public sector and the private sector. And I would probably invest some of it also in very innovative companies, but I would be very, very careful about it, because I think that what we're talking about, when we're talking about €500 billion of defense spending, we are talking about building a European defense force. No, I was at the dinner. With an ambassador of a European country. I'm not going to say which one. This is a country that has a lot of problems. And they said, we expect Europe to project its power to help us solve our problems. But Europe doesn't have power to project at the moment. So if you want to maintain European values, if we want to maintain European values, if you want to maintain the humanistic approach, the pluralistic and liberal approach that we have, if we want to protect our liberal democracies, we need to take action.
Yaron, you mentioned many deep tech technologies. But many deep tech startups actually struggle with scaling. What's the... And let's again talk about Europe. What's the key to turning deep tech prototype or deep tech startup into a global commercial success?
I think you're raising a very interesting question. That is something that I was thinking about a lot, because I think that if I look back at my career as a venture capitalist, the challenge that I always thought about in the early days was a technological challenge. Can they do it? Is there a need for what they do? And I didn't think so much about how to approach the market. And what I've learned in, 25 years of doing venture capital is that most of the problems most of the technological problems are solvable. I'm talking about the technological problems that startups tackle, are solvable problems. Yeah. What is much less solvable and much more of an art is the go-to-market. And if you fail, many times you fail on that. And certainly when you scale, because you raise, 20 or 30 or 100 or 500 million, whatever it took to get to your product. But then you are failing on things that are completely orthogonal to this. You're failing on regulation. You're failing on approaching your customers. You're failing on proving ROI. Sometimes you have an excellent solution, but the solution has a negative net margin because the other solutions are much, much cheaper. And even if you include the replacement value and the fixing value and whatever, they're much cheaper. So it's thinking about these aspects first and foremost. Also, when you plan your startup. And when you're talking about deep tech, this is especially true, because it needs to be the competitive advantage that you have needs to be so well defined that even if it takes you 15 years to build the technology, I'm exaggerating on purpose, it will be trivial for someone to buy. And that also solves backwards the amount of time that you have in order to build your technology, because at the end of the day, if you don't have a competitive advantage that is so unique that will build such a big barrier between you and the rest of the market, don't do a startup. It's too difficult. not for an incremental value.
Yaron, so, you know, what's going to be the next, what are going to be the next biggest European companies? What's going to be the next unicorn coming from?
First of all, if I knew what the next unicorn is going to be, I would have invested in it myself. So look at my recent investments, and that shows you what I think are the next unicorns. But I think that there are pockets of excellence in Europe that are producing amazing companies, and this is really across the board. You see it in fintech and insurtech when I've been investing a lot. You see it in industry, companies that are in the robotics or AI space or are on the cusp of robotics and AI, so merging the two industries. Take a look at a company called RoboVision in our portfolio, for example. So that's one thing. Then, you know, another thing is solving huge problems. I'll give you an example. One of the least sexy startups that we have is a startup that's called Magnus Metal, which is making 3D printers for high tensile strength metal parts. So basically, if you have a tractor, or if you're John Deere and you deploy tractors in the field, then you don't need to send spare parts thousands of kilometers. Now, this also has military applications, right? Because if you think about supply lines in military, this is a huge problem. So I would look at these traditional innovations and traditional and marriage between high tech and industry, because Europe has amazing industry. If you think about the power of Germany, the power of Germany is manufacturing. It's not a services economy. It's not the UK, right? Germany remained a manufacturing economy to a large extent. Harness that power. See what's the delta that's missing between where you are and where you want to be, and let's focus on that delta. And I think focusing on the delta is primarily a question of education in Europe. So I'm coming roundabout, you know, to the end of your question, because I think that also if we look at startups in education, they have potential of becoming really, really big and really impactful. I'm referring to companies from my portfolio. Excuse me for the vanity, but companies like Master School, which are really transforming tech education across Europe. Mm-hmm. So you know they're active today in Germany and in several other countries, and really transforming tech education in these countries. We need to think about that because we need a lot of skilled labor to meet these challenges.
Yaron, why? You know, countries like, I don't know, US, like other players on the market, the biggest players. Like, why do you think people don't really believe that the next big category defining companies can, you know, come out of Europe?
But I'm not sure that that's true. I think that Europe is at the forefront of defining many paradigms. In quantum, in AI, look, the only Nobel Prize that we have for AI so far is the European guy, right? Greek-British guy. Demis Hassabis, the founder of DeepMind. Yeah. So, you know, we have not only in fusion and in quantum and in aerospace and in AI, we have real thought leadership in Europe. It's not that Europe is not leading. It's Europe is leading. You know, most of the innovation in Europe, or much of the innovation in Europe, is being done with big companies. And that's the thing that I told you that needs to change. You know, there is a very, very interesting theory in management about creative destruction. The entire genesis of Silicon Valley is because NASA decided to close down its operations in Silicon Valley or reduce the number of people, not close down, but reduce the number of people.
Yeah.
And then you had tens of thousands of engineers that were in the streets. Something very similar happened to Israel in the 80s. We had a fighter jet project that employed 100,000 people. I don't know how many, out of a country of whatever, 3.5 million. And suddenly 30,000 people were let go. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very skilled. So they started companies. Same thing happened in Silicon Valley. And same thing happens all the time in Silicon Valley. If you look at European companies, which are the biggest companies in Europe? They were the same biggest companies 100 years ago. So there's no creative destruction. The European companies are too good. They're being punished because they're good. Or rather, the society is being punished because it's so good. And then again, you know, one of the solutions for this is immigration. You need to have more hungry people, hungry for success, not hungry for food, but hungry for success. Mm-hmm. And immigration is a key in this respect. And Europe needs to learn how to accept immigration, how to accept not only the right type of immigration that it wants, but also a general immigration and how to integrate people and how to make them feel that they are part of the European story. And then these people would become productive citizens and create, a competitive advantage for Europe for generations to come.
Yeah, Yaron. So actually, that's a good moment to mention that. Maybe you can tell us how can immigration save Europe? I've heard that you're writing a book on that particular topic.
Thank you. Thank you. No, look. I think that if we look statistically in Europe, it's in decline. It's in demographic decline and it's in economic decline, and it risks becoming an irrelevant place in 100 years, 200 years. I don't know how these things happen, but you know, over time it will decrease in relevance.
Yeah.
And the way to offset this, you can't generate demographic growth out of nothing. It needs to create a psychological change. Or it needs a psychological change, sorry, that people will go through, and that's not so easy. Immigration, if we look at countries that accept immigration and have accepted immigration traditionally, countries like Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Israel, you see that these countries benefited from immigration and they reaped massive benefits from it. You know, for example, in the US, 50% of the unicorns are started by immigrants.
Yeah,
incredible. And you know, I'm sure that Israel would be the same because everyone here is an immigrant, and you know, maybe one or two generations out, maybe three generations out, but most of us are immigrants. So it needs to be to learn how to harness the power of immigration without losing its identity, without stopping to be Europe or the Europe we know. And it can. It's again a question of integration and a question of giving the right tools to people, and also a question of acknowledging the fact that you accept two types of immigration. Mm-hmm. One type is immigration that you accept because this is the immigration you desire, and one type is the immigration that you accept because you're a global citizen. Both are right, but you need to acknowledge this, and you need to, or we need to, implement this into our way of thinking.
So, Yaron, so how do you harness the power of immigration?
So, immigrants create companies. Immigrants don't have a net to fall back on. They don't have anyone that will save them if they don't work. And because of that, you see a lot of startups that are being created by immigrants. Basically, what you see usually, especially when you talk about immigration from less developed countries, you see that the first generation is going on survival. They will take whatever job they need to survive, but they will teach their kids to be hungry and to aspire, and then their kids many times create companies. We see larger companies in the second generation of immigrants. If you don't integrate these people, then they will just leave. They will just leave and they will go to wherever is convenient for them. They will not have roots. So in order to harness the power of immigration, you need to provide a pluralistic environment, but at the same time, you need to know and demand that people integrate with your way, with your values, not necessarily with your way of life, but with your values, because otherwise you lose your identity. By combining these two things, by working on integration of immigrants, not just saying it, not just giving immigrants German lessons and culture lessons, which is what Germany is doing. Germany is, you know, giving you a few months of these things and then setting you loose. But a more fundamental change, And again, this is where national service can come into play. Because if you look at the great equalizer in Israel, it's always national service. So if Europe wants to harness the power of immigration, it needs to think how to make immigrants become part of it. The second generation, the third generation, and then give them opportunities to start companies.
Yeah.
I'll give you a crazy example. About 30%, 25% of businesses in Victorian England were opened by immigrants, 19th century. So you can see even then the huge power of immigration. Think about 25, 30% of businesses in Victorian England. It's amazing.
Yeah. It is amazing. Yaron, let's look ahead, like, I don't know, 10 years from now. What's one piece of technology that doesn't exist yet, but absolutely should?
Teleporters.
Right? And we wouldn't do this. Like,
that would be amazing. No,
the studio with me.
Exactly. So fantasizing, I want teleporters. General AI, I think, is going to be the big thing.
Yeah.
We're going to see, you know, less companies that are doing the nuts and bolts of AI, and the ones that are doing it are going to be very big and provide a lot of different use cases, or an infinite number of use cases almost. So we'll see amazing achievements in AI, which will influence everything from drug discovery. You know, we mentioned the Nobel Prize of AlphaFold of Dennis Hassabis before. A company like AlphaFold, which basically discovered every protein in existence, has immense applications in the medical field, and we will see more and more of those. You know, we saw a little bit. We saw, for example, the fact that we could have RNA vaccines from Europe in record time.
Yeah,
we keep forgetting that that European companies saved the planet. Less than 4 years ago.
True, Yaron. When is the book coming out?
Hopefully by the end of the year. So we are now about halfway through. I hope that by the end of the year it will be out.
Is it like how do you come around to like put it together? Do you have some collaborations or some let's say some collaborations with the government? Like how do you?
No. Look, it's a very small team of people that is working with me together on it. People that are like-minded and think that the issue of immigration is we are passionate about the issue of immigration, and we are passionate about making Europe a better place that is that has adapted to the challenges of the 21st century, and that's how it came about. So it's a combination of research and management executives that are passionate about this.
I love it. Yaron, can't wait to see the book. Can't wait to read it. Looking forward for it to come out.
Thank you
so much for taking time and joining us today on the podcast. I think people will love it. Very insightful again. And I hope to see you sometime soon in Barcelona or wherever else around Europe. Thanks so much. Hope you enjoyed it as well.
Very much. Thank you very much.